We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Diving in with local and more continuing developments coming out of City Hall.
A few things coming out of City Council and the mayor's office. First, on Monday, Mayor Durkin announced an extension of the city's eviction moratorium to June 30th. It was set to expire on March 31st, so, of course, there's nothing like waiting until as late as you can to announce this.
Yeah, and the state chimed in on Thursday with the same kind of announcement. So they would be the same date.
So I think they may have been coordinating there a little bit. And this preempted an effort by the city council to pass a bill to extend the moratorium through the end of the year, not just to June 30th. That bill is now on hold. And it could be revived later in the year if we still are under lockdown conditions in June, which everyone is hoping that we won't be, but you just don't know about the future. And then also this week, U.S. District Court Judge John Kugenhauer struck down the case that the grocery industry had brought against Seattle's new law that says that grocery store owners must provide their workers a $4 per hour hazard pay for working during the COVID-19 pandemic on top of their regular pay. Kugenhauer found that not a single one of the arguments put forth by the Northwest Grocery Association had merit in this case. The case is now headed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where it will probably be consolidated with a similar case coming out of Long Beach, California, which also passed a hazard pay ordinance for grocery store workers. In the meantime, because Kugenhauer refused to issue an injunction, the law is still in effect, and grocery stores are required to provide that extra $4 per hour to their employees currently. And then also this week, in news out of City Hall, Just Cares, the program that has removed long-term chronically homeless people from Pioneer Square in the International District and is sheltering those folks in hotels and providing case services for them, like drug treatment, mental health services, legal help, and other things to help them get stabilized and off the street. Just Cares has received a $5 million in survival funding from King County. Its funding was scheduled to run out at some point this month without an infusion of cash from either the county or the city of Seattle. And Just Cares had asked the city of Seattle if they would contribute, since most of the work that they're doing is to help folks who are inside the city of Seattle, particularly those two neighborhoods, Pioneer Square and the International District. Mayor Durkin, however, refused to consider providing any new funding for hotel-based shelters, arguing that it's too expensive per person, particularly the Just Cares program being much more expensive than basic emergency shelter functions provided by places like the Downtown Emergency Services Center. But the two services are not comparable in any way. The DESC provides congregate shelters, essentially a big room with the mat on the floor, right, which doesn't protect homeless folks from the pandemic, but also doesn't provide a lot of services for them. Whereas the hotel-based shelter program that Just Cares runs provides complete wraparound services, as well as a really nice place for people to go. Not luxury, but at least a place with a shower and a bathroom and some privacy.
So I'm having a problem with this because didn't the city stop emergency shelter for places like Share Wheel and transition instead to funding places like the Navigation Center that had those kind of wraparound services, even though the cost per person was much more expensive?
That was the policy, yeah. But the practice has been quite different. And Durkin is arguing that enhanced shelters, which is what you're talking about, have to meet a price ceiling in order for the city to fund them. And she's also denying what other what shelter providers are telling her, which is that, look, FEMA is providing funding. The federal government through FEMA is providing funding for getting homeless people off the street into separate living facilities from each other. So out of the congregate shelters and off the street into places where they're less likely to spread COVID-19 and where it, and we should be taking advantage of that funding to get them off the street. And at the same time, providing them the services that they need to get stabilized and get into permanent housing, to get jobs, to get drug treatment, to get mental health, their mental health issues treated, to, you know, find work if they can, to get them signed up for assistance, regular assistance programs if they qualify for disability or something like that.
Treat them like human beings,
Yeah, essentially. And Durkin's saying, no, I don't think FEMA is going to pay for any of that. And yet there are dozens of cities around the U.S. right now who are getting those services paid for by FEMA. You know, the difference is that they're willing to fill out the paperwork, whereas the Durkin administration is not. Now, the city is currently providing funding to two hotel-based programs that will provide a total of 200 beds. That's a tiny number given the need and the amount of work that could that the city could be doing. To address this, City Council member Andrew Lewis, who chairs the council's Special Committee on Homelessness, has been negotiating with the mayor's office on a bill that could provide money for hotel-based shelters, but is much more likely to fund more congregate emergency shelters and a few more tiny house villages, which really don't provide the same kind of amenities that you find in these hotel-based shelters. For example, there's a big difference between a mat on the floor in a group living situation where, you know, you're sleeping next to somebody who's having a psychotic break or something. Or being parked inside of a box that's about the size of a large closet without many amenities to go with it, and being in a place that has a real bed, has a shower, has a toilet, has a small kitchen, a space for you to store your belongings, and provides services for, say, drug treatment if you have an addiction
and not just a place to store belongings, but a place to store it that's secure, because one of the problems with congregate shelters is people's stuff gets stolen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a big, big difference there. And in fact, in places like New Orleans, in San Francisco, in cities all over California, there are hotel-based shelters being funded by those cities, and they're getting nearly full reimbursement from FEMA for those services. And there's not a big delay in the reimbursement program either, like the Durkin administration is claiming. So it just seems to me like it's more a policy that Jenny Durkin's in her last year as mayor, and she's just not going to do anything new. You know?
Yeah, well, she's generally hasn't been doing anything, period. So
It's a bit like a holdover from the Trump administration. You know, his last year in office, he wasn't really going to do anything that he didn't want to do anyway, you know, except to play to his base. And in this case, Durkin's not trying to be reelected, so she's just not doing anything, essentially.
And in addition to those, the hotel industry is hurting big time and could use that shot in the arm. You know, again, it just
seems like, why not? If the feds are providing the funding, let's use it for something important that will make a real meaningful difference in the lives of these people who are on the street, and also make a meaningful difference for the small businesses and medium-sized businesses that are struggling to stay open or are having to deal with increased shoplifting from folks who are desperate and or may be living on the street. And dealing with, you know, increased litter and customers complaining about, you know, a homeless encampment nearby. You know, why not address, you know, those issues?
Downtown businesses can't complain about homelessness as being the cause of the going out of business right now. It's having to be shut down the last year. And and, you know, and extremely high leases. But, you know, since it, you can't blame the homeless, they just don't exist. And one of the problems with the hotel, motel-based rooms is that it treats homeless people like human beings. And you know, the city can't have that. That attitude has permeated their homelessness approach for a couple of decades now.
So perhaps there will be changes if there were new people in City Hall.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that.
Let's talk about the election news this week. Two more candidates have joined the mayor's race. Doesn't that sound a little like deja vu from last week? including the fact that one of them is a former athlete. This week, first off, a three-term city council member, Bruce Harrell, announced that he will run for mayor. Harrell was a linebacker at the University of Washington. He's a former athlete. And then later in the week, former state representative Jessen Farrell jumped into the race. Harrell, of course, is decidedly a pro-business candidate. There's no question there. And he could wave the banner for the pro-right-wing business community. Farrell is more progressive.
I think Harrell is trying to forestall a run from Tim Burgess, which is, you know, I think Burgess is going to run anyway. Honestly.
Oh, we'll see. Yeah. I'm also hearing some rumors that folks are trying to talk former governor and ambassador to China and Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke into jumping into the mayor's race, which would, you know, pretty much close out any other candidates right there, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. The possibility of Dow Constantine running for mayor is also still out there.
Yeah. And then of course this week, former state representative Jessen Farrell, and Farrell's more progressive than Harrell, but still within the mainstream of the Democratic Party, and I wouldn't necessarily call her the progressive choice in the race.
She finished a fairly strong fourth in the mayoral primary 4 years ago.
Yeah, when it was really close between the second place candidate to make it through the primary between Carrie Moon, Nikita Oliver, and Jessen Farrell. She was right there in the mix, and Carrie Moon just edged past the other two. So I think, you know, at this point, just asking the question of would this person be better than Jenny Durkin is not a very high bar, because there are candidates. There are candidates in the race who don't have any real experience of city politics, very similar to Durkin. And I think that includes people like Colleen Echo Hawk, Lance Randall of Seed, and of course, James Donaldson. But there's now a mix of career politicians in the race who know the main issues that the city is dealing with, if not necessarily what needs to be done to fix those or address those issues. And of the three most experienced candidates, Harrell is the most conservative so far, with Jessen Farrell and Lorena Gonzalez kind of left to duke it out over who gets to pick up the vote in the middle and on the left. And of course, Andrew Grant Houston is raising quite a bit of money and may still try to position himself to the left of both Gonzalez and Farrell. But he lacks their name recognition. So, that's kind of the race as it's shaping up right now. But, you know, as Java and I were just saying, more candidates may jump into the race. And
it's still 2 months to the filing deadline.
Yeah, don't think the field is set yet.
Yeah, there really is not a progressive option right now.
Yeah.
And that's concerning. And I would think that is, you know, somebody's going to jump in and try and take advantage of that lane, I think. And then, yeah. And then Burgess is still out there too. And he is still trying to maintain his visibility and keep his options open, I think.
Yeah. Now, all of the candidates that I've mentioned are taking democracy vouchers, as are Teresa Mosqueda, who's running practically unopposed in the city council position 8, Pete Holmes, who's running for re-election unopposed for city attorney, and two of the three leading candidates running for city council position 9, Nikita Oliver and Brianna Thomas, are both taking democracy vouchers. Sarah Nelson, also in that race, and the pro-business candidate. She has not qualified for democracy vouchers just yet and has not said whether she'll take them.
She's probably waiting for that $1 million Microsoft or Amazon donation.
Yeah, or Downtown Business Association donation, something like that. And also,
laundered through the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce's PAC, of course.
Yeah, and also this week, former city council member and former interim mayor Tim Burgess, which we were just talking about, announced that he would be introducing a new citywide initiative to fund new homeless services out of the existing money in the city budget, which, of course, means that something else would have to be chopped out of the budget. He said the initiative would also require many tent encampments to be swept, which means the city would have to revive the navigation team or something similar to it if this initiative were to pass. He didn't announce a date for when the initiative would be filed, nor did he present the actual wording of the initiative. But it would have to be soon, I would think, if he wants to collect the 33,000 signatures he needs to get it on the ballot. I'm guessing maybe he's just waiting to see if he wants to do it, which election he wants that initiative to appear on.
And
also to see if we really fully come out of the pandemic lockdown, because then that'll make it easier to collect signatures. So just so you know, if you have any illusions about what Tim Burgess is up to, the revival of the navigation team is right there at the top of his list.
Yeah, I think he's overestimating the number of people in this city who would be supportive of going back to the bad old days of city policy. But certainly it's a policy that he seems wed to.
Yeah.
And he's trying to keep his name in the mix for mayoral leadership in the business community.
Yeah. And the fact is that those signatures on an initiative have to be registered voters. And while I feel that the city has a significant population of conservatives now, with a lot of Amazon workers living in South Lake Union.
Tech workers in general. Yeah.
High paid tech workers in general tend to be either very mainstream or at least further to the right than most of your standard Seattle liberals or Seattle progressives. So I feel like there's a significant population that swings to the right here in Seattle now, but they're not necessarily registered voters and they don't necessarily know much or care much about local politics, at least yet. So I think that you're right, Job. I think it might be difficult for him to get that many signatures unless he utilizes, has a lot of money and utilizes a lot of paid signature gatherers.
I mean, we've seen a very vocal right-wing anti-homeless contingent emerge in city politics in the last couple of years. But in primaries, the candidates tend to get only 10% or so of the electorate. Mm-hmm. They're overrepresented in noisy demonstrations, but underrepresented in terms of actual registered voters.
Yeah. So we'll see how that does. So that kind of wraps up my news for the city this week.
All right. What developments did you find of interest at the state legislature?
At the state legislature? Well, first of all, legislators got some good news this week when the state's latest revenue forecast showed that the state's tax revenue is projected to increase by $3.3 billion through 2023, a very big jump from the last forecast. This puts the state's tax revenue close to where it was before the pandemic hit, albeit, 3 years after the pandemic hit. Now, a large part of that increase is from the one-time $12 billion infusion of cash that Washington State is projected to get from the new stimulus bill just passed by the U.S. Congress. In addition, the housing market has hit record highs and not slowed at all by the pandemic. So real estate excise taxes are up, and that's helped the state's revenues. And the retail sales tax collections are up as well, because even though people are at home and not out shopping, online shopping has really soared. And the state passed a bill not long ago requiring online retailers to charge state sales tax to sales made in Washington state. So that has boosted the state's coffers quite a bit. So that's going to help with draft budget. So that revenue increase is really going to help the state legislature draft a budget for this year, because they'll have some extra wiggle room there in the budget for financing some of the state's needs and some of the Democrats' priorities this time around. Now, the House committees are working hard to try to pass a flurry of bills through the committee to the House floor, although not many passed through this week. And at the same time, they're working hard on their draft of the budget. And it seems to me like the budget is going to be initiated in the House and probably move to the Senate from there. Now, several bills, on the other hand, are moving through the Senate and have hit the Senate floor. And these bills, of course, were ones that originated in the House. So I just want to talk about five of those bills, which I found were quite interesting this week. So, and the fact that they have passed through the House already and have moved and have survived through the committees in the Senate and have now reached the Senate floor is a good sign that they may pass and are highly likely to pass this year. So at the top of the list is House Bill 1070, which expands the ability for local governments to use sales and use taxes for affordable housing, transitional housing, and supportive housing and services. It also allows counties with a population of more than 1.5 million, essentially just King County, to use revenue from the lodging tax for sheltering homeless youth. So that's good news. That bill is very highly likely to pass. House Bill 1078 would automatically restore voting rights for former felons who've served their sentence. That bill is also on the Senate floor and highly likely to pass. In addition, there is House Bill 1109, which would expand the rights of sexual assault victims, including referral to sexual assault programs and services, and the notification to sexual assault victims of the status of the law enforcement investigation and prosecution of their cases, so they don't have to keep begging for information from their local police department and keep writing them to try to get action. It also requires minimum training for law enforcement agencies on how to treat sexual assault victims and how to pursue these cases, and has some requirements in the bill on reporting milestones in sexual assault investigation of sexual assault cases. So it's a very good bill and has reached the Senate floor and is highly likely to pass. Another bill on the floor of the Senate right now is House Bill 1090. This is very good news. This is the bill that would ban the use of private prisons and detention facilities in Washington state, with some exceptions, including facilities for mental health and substance abuse treatment and for public health, for example, in the case of a pandemic. This would be a major win for folks who have been opposing privately run immigration detention facilities here in Washington state. And it's a big boost to folks who have been working with prisoners, trying to integrate them back into society after they've served their sentence, or to help them get into transitional programs, because trying to work with those private prison facilities is very, very difficult compared to working with a state agency that has to follow certain rules and requirements and provide information. And this bill is astoundingly good news, House Bill 1090. So keep an eye on that. That one is widely expected to pass. And I'm assuming Governor Inslee will sign it. And then finally, House Bill 1114, this one kind of snuck by me when it was on its way through the House, but I saw it on the floor of the Senate, and it's an interesting one. It would encourage utilities to help their customers purchase and install energy conservation equipment, and included in that definition of energy conservation equipment are things like cool roofs, green roofs, and planting trees. Yes, planting trees is considered energy conservation equipment. It allows electric utilities to collect donations from their customers for urban forestry programs as well. So a very, very good bill, kind of flew under the radar there for a lot of folks, especially for me. But one of the many, many steps that the Democrats are taking to try to address climate change and try to address greenhouse gas emissions here in Washington state.
I would be happier if that bill also included those kind of tax credits for developers, because that's where a lot of urban forestry has been lost in the last 50 years in this region.
Yeah. And, you know, there are some, there is a bill making its way through the legislature right now that addresses, green buildings, but not anything that addresses encouraging developers to maintain, tree canopy or maintain trees on their property. And so far that's something that the state has left to municipalities, to pass ordinances on. And something that I think would be a good thing for the city council also to take a look at.
Yeah.
So for the state legislature, the next cutoff date is this coming Friday, March 26th, which is the last day to pass bills that originated in the opposite house out of committee to the House or Senate floor. And if those bills don't relate to fiscal matters or the state budget, approximately a week after this coming Friday, or 2 weeks from now, on April 2nd, is the deadline for fiscal bills to pass out of their committees to the floor of their respective chambers. So a couple of deadlines coming up. And this next week, we're going to see a flurry of bills pass out of committee in both the House and Senate. And we'll see which bills survive. And if you want to track any of these bills or track bills that I've talked about in past shows, you can always look up the bills by bill numbers, or search for bills by subject matter on the Washington State Legislature's website. That is leg.wa.gov. Click on bill information on the left to look up bills by their bill number or subject matter. On the main page, you'll see a list of committees meeting on the day that you visit the website. And if you click on a committee, it'll take you to that committee's page, where you can sign up to testify or watch the committee hearing online. You can also watch past committee hearings online as well if you click on the page for the committee. You have to sign up if you want to testify for an upcoming hearing. You have to sign up at least an hour before the committee meeting starts. That URL again is leg.wa.gov.
And it really is a remarkable resource. The state does a very good job of allowing people to track bills and track legislation and track committee hearings through that site. So
yes.
Check it out.
Yes,
check
and I recommend when you click on a bill and you open up the bills page that you scroll down and click on the report, the latest reports, and read the bill reports. And you can see kind of a summary of what that bill is about. You get a little bit of background on the history.
And it's written in plain English, too, mm-hmm. which is important.
Very readable.
The bills often are not. So.
Yeah, bills sometimes are not. And although I would encourage you to actually read the bills occasionally, because it would surprise you how easy to read some of them are. So.
Yeah, especially bills that you're interested in specifically. Mm-hmm. It's worth the effort.
Yeah. So, very good resource. And I want to commend the state of Washington for providing this information in a very clear way without lots of bells and lots of graphics and bells and whistles that can slow down your browser or be a more of a distraction than a help.
Yeah. And the Department of Health has also done a similar job with COVID information. It's very accessible and it's very stripped down, so it doesn't slow down your browser.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on. At least one local Seattle church getting additional graffiti this week.
Yeah, two, in fact, last weekend. Two Asian Christian churches in North Seattle got graffiti like that. And it's interesting because with the shootings in Georgia this week, which we'll talk about in a minute. You know, the entire nation was going through a reckoning with instances of anti-Asian hate that have been spawned by the pandemic and the former president. An incident like that in Seattle, where two different churches were hit last weekend, sort of came and went very quickly in local news and wasn't cited very much as an example of, yes, we've got that problem here too. But we do. We do have people in the community who are racist blank heads. I can't really say that on the radio, so I won't. And it's something that needs to be confronted in our local politics, very much so. And, you know, we also heard a lot of local stories of people of Asian descent feeling fearful over the last year, because they don't feel safe in public. And that is also a serious concern.
Yeah, I think we saw an overall increase in hate crimes during the Trump administration, but because of the continual mention of COVID-19 as the China virus, that a lot of that's been directed towards the Asian community, Asian American community, and that is deeply unfortunate and something that we as everyday citizens have the responsibility to try to reverse that as much as possible.
Yeah. And confront it when it happens.
And confront it when we see it and when we're witnesses to it.
Okay. Let's move on to local developments with police.
Last Saturday, in fact, was the first anniversary of the death of Breonna Taylor. And we saw large demonstrations in a lot of different cities to commemorate that. In Seattle, a relatively peaceful demonstration down the waterfront was attacked seemingly without provocation by Seattle police. And some people were arrested. That kind of police misbehavior against peaceful protests doesn't even make the news these days. So I wanted to flag it as something that is still happening with the lack of, permanent leadership at SPD and the lack of interest in police accountability at the mayor's office.
Yeah, and I want to remind the mayor's office and I want to remind our interim chief of police that just because we have a pandemic and a pandemic lockdown, the Bill of Rights has not been suspended. People's right to free speech is still in effect. So just trying to shove people off the street and shut them up is not okay.
Yeah. And this week, the Seattle Times, I believe, was the first to report that a really unfortunate incident involving the Pierce County Sheriff in late January, where the sheriff saw in the very early morning hours a black man going door to door. And so he called into the dispatch saying the man did threaten to kill him. The man turned out to be a 24-year-old African-American paper deliverer, going door-to-door delivering papers on his usual route. And once detectives questioned the sheriff, he recanted the story of the threat. But people now are calling for the Pierce County Sheriff, a guy named Ed Troyer, to resign, and Washington State BLM in particular has been very vocal demanding his resignation, or at least a suspension while that incident is investigated. But it underscores once again the problematic nature of race issues within local law enforcement when a guy at that high a level can engage in such a blatantly racist profiling incident.
Well, and lie as well, and
yeah,
feel that
sure.
He can get away with that.
Yep.
And how someone would, being a person that used to have to wake up at like 4 a.m. And would be outside to come into work, how you wouldn't recognize a paper delivery person blows my mind. It's like it's really evident what the heck
they're obvious.
Doing.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Pretty obvious.
You see them coming down the block. They go a house or two forward. You hear the paper go thunk. You know,
yeah. They're throwing something at the houses. Oh my God! Yeah, it's a newspaper, idiot.
Yeah, he's dropping off stuff, not picking up stuff. You know, it's kind of it's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, you've really got to have a preset imagination as to what a person of color might be doing at that time of morning in order to engage in that. And how the lying about the threat came about is anybody's guess, but maybe he realized after he started calling it in his mistake and scrambled for a way to justify it. I don't know. Makes no sense. But it's pretty bad, regardless mm-hmm. of how you cut it.
So, and as Job pointed out when he started this, that was, again, an incident that happened in January, but brought to light from Seattle Times in this instance, digging up more details on it. So,
yeah, because the initial incident report became public. Became a public record, but it underscores once again how little local media there is and how few media outlets have the capacity to do that kind of reading.
All right. Well, let's move on to this week's COVID news.
Oh yeah. Well, there's plenty. Once again, this week we saw an expansion of the state pandemic relief, in this case, an expansion of the eligibility for the vaccine. The vaccine is now eligible for anybody over the age of 50, I believe. No, excuse me, adults with two or more comorbidities that were life-threatening comorbidity, excuse me. We saw an announcement of a coming expansion for anybody over with one or more comorbidity, as well as teachers in the state, as well as what else was there?
So what I have on my list is that Inslee announced that starting March 31st, that an additional 2 million people would be eligible for the vaccine.
Yeah, that's
restaurant workers and construction workers who were left out of his earlier announcement of expanding the vaccine to teachers. Also, manufacturing workers, people with two or more comorbidities, homeless people, incarcerated folks, and people aged 60 to 64 years old will all be able to get the vaccine starting on March 31st if there's enough supply. And I think that if there's enough supply is a big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and interestingly, I mean, that's a good list, but left off the list still are postal carriers, which makes no sense to me. You know, people, delivery drivers and people who go door to door are now covered, or now eligible, I should say. But postal carriers are not, and nobody can figure out why.
Yeah, and another cohort is people over the age of 50. Since that was the original CDC age cutoff, saying that you're at higher risk if you're over 50. So those of us who are between 50 and 60 have been kind of sitting on our hands going, when are we eligible? When are we eligible?
Yeah,
we're at higher risk.
And I have comorbidities, and I'm finally scheduled for next Tuesday, but I've been waiting for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And people with those comorbidities are the highest risk to come out with negative outcomes from the virus.
Yeah.
But that's not what the state has been going by. The state has been going by how likely are you to spread it to others. So that seems to kind of
makes sense. But again, it's all this, you know, picking and choosing based on the fact that we don't have enough vaccine right now.
Yeah.
So I hear the question regularly, should I get the vaccine if I've already had COVID-19? And
yes.
The answer is yes, absolutely, especially if you have COVID long haul syndrome. And that's if you have debilitating symptoms that have lasted weeks or even months after you got ill or tested positive.
And we haven't had a chance to see studies from that yet, but we've gotten a lot of anecdotal evidence that if you have long haul, Getting the vaccine can help.
Yeah. So, there are studies that are being conducted right now, and what they're finding early results are that somewhere between 30% and 40%, depending on the study, of people with COVID long haul syndrome experience an improvement in their symptoms after they get the vaccine. And it makes sense with what we know about the virus and how it can evade the immune system in some people. The vaccine may help your immune system to better recognize the virus and attack and eliminate it from your system. So
yeah.
Definitely get it.
We've also gotten a lot of stories of people who don't have symptoms who wind up getting long haul.
Who don't initially have any symptoms that they were sick.
Where it can come weeks or months afterwards. And, you know, for some reason, the virus can remain dormant in some part of the body for a period of time. The vaccine probably can help with that.
Yeah. And speaking of that, this week there was news from a different pandemic, which raised questions of whether people can completely eliminate COVID-19 from their systems or if they're going to carry it for very long term. In January, a new outbreak of the Ebola virus began in Guinea in West Africa. Full genome sequencing of that virus from several recently infected people has found that that virus is nearly identical to the virus that caused the 2014 to 2016 Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And this is really astounding news. This means that the virus has been hiding out inside human hosts in parts of their body that are protected from attack by the human immune system, so-called privilege zones, like the inside of your eyeball, the central nervous system, and the testes or gonads in men. And apparently they think that a man who survived an Ebola infection nearly 5 years ago was carrying the virus in his testicles and passed it on to a sex partner, which started this new outbreak. And this really changes the timeline for how long researchers thought a virus could survive hiding out inside a human host.
And particularly a coronavirus, which the Ebola is part of that family also.
The previous record was thought to be 500 days for a virus to be hiding out inside of a reservoir in a human host, or about a year and a half. 5 years now puts that timeline out further and really makes it seem like a virus could survive indefinitely inside a human reservoir. And what this means is that getting vaccinated is more important than ever. People who are, because, you know, the longer, and I think this is true, the longer you, and more serious illness that you have with a virus, the more likely it is for you to have a high viral load or a lot of the virus in your system, the more likely it is to make its way into these reservoir areas of your body, these privileged zones.
And we also have millions of people who have been infected now, something like over 120 million. So that's a lot of potential humans for a virus to be hiding in.
Yeah, so I think we really just need to work harder to persuade people to get the shot, especially those folks who are refusing to get vaccinated. And I think what's at the root of that partially is a fear of needles, getting a little poke in the arm. I think people have just got to get over that. You know?
There's also a lot of parts of the world that simply haven't had access to vaccines yet, especially sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, but I'm very deeply troubled by hearing that almost a third of healthcare workers, for example, have refused to get the vaccine. So, you know, things like that. And I just kind of feel like, you know, the risk is not worth it. Get the poke in the arm, you know, be sick for a day or two if you feel side effects from the vaccine, and then get it done.
You know,
because it's not just you. It's whether or not we're going to be dealing with COVID-19 for decades.
Yeah. And you know, the messaging from the former president didn't help in that respect. And I think there's still a large reservoir of people who took that to heart. And we saw Trump actually encourage people in a Fox News interview this week to get vaccinated. But, you know, it's probably too little too late, honestly.
Yeah, and I think also we need to do better at fighting misinformation about the COVID-19 vaccines and vaccines in general, because there's a large number of people online who, you know, they love to doubt, and I'm okay with the fact that they love to doubt or question. But when you question scientific studies, you need to be aware that if you don't have a science background and you start saying things that aren't true, that's spreading misinformation. So I think we need to challenge that wherever we can in a respectful way, you know, not just start, you know, getting into knockdown, drag out fights with people, but to just very seriously say and very respectfully and gently say, no, I don't think that's actually true.
Yeah. And, and both Twitter and Facebook, which are, you know, the sort of primary cesspools for this sort of thing, have said that they want to combat misinformation online. So report it, you know. Sometimes they'll act and sometimes they won't, but it's worth a try.
Yeah, and try to refrain from attacking people saying you, and saying instead, this information is not correct. You know, try to keep it on topic and just say, I'm here about making sure that the information that we're discussing is the right information.
Good information. And, you know, you may think that the person is an idiot, but don't say it because it doesn't help.
No, it doesn't. So
even though they are. So I wanted to mention also, speaking of global issues, that the AstraZeneca blood clot scare sort of came and went this week. Early in the week, a number of different European countries paused the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is a vaccine in most widespread use in Europe and much of the world, because of reports out of Scandinavia that some patients had gotten blood clots after receiving that vaccine. That was mostly anecdotal. By Thursday, the chief regulator for the European Union had said, no, AstraZeneca is safe. The WHO had chimed in that, yes, it's safe. On Friday, the UK Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, very publicly got an AstraZeneca vaccine shot, and by Friday, most of the embargoes on use of that vaccine had been lifted, so it does seem to be in use once again. The United States has still not approved the AstraZeneca vaccine and had a large stockpile of that vaccine that was set to age out that was shipped this week to Canada and Mexico, two countries, neighboring countries, obviously, that have approved that vaccine for use. It was AstraZeneca had applied to the FDA for emergency authorization in December, and you know, 3 months later, that still has not happened. So we're still waiting on that.
Mm-hmm. And I think the FDA is more questioning the effectiveness of the AstraZeneca vaccine rather than the safety issues. And it's important for people to realize too that there can be issues with administering a drug that can affect whether, you know, how people respond to it as well.
Early in the clinical trials, the AstraZeneca numbers were not good, and they apparently fixed those issues, but the FDA is doing its own studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to be aware too that the FDA is far more cautious than a lot of the agencies in other parts of the world that approve the use of drugs and medications. So it's not unusual for it to take twice as long here in the U.S. to get something approved as it does in Europe or Canada or Mexico.
One other COVID-related development I wanted to mention is that Russia has been using pandemic restrictions to round up a lot of opposition leaders this week and place them under house arrest, saying they violated, you know, curfews or whatever. And that's seeming to be using the pandemic as a justification for a political crackdown, which is a very disturbing development.
Oh, you mean a little like the Seattle Police Department here?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, no. Human rights should not be suspended just because of the pandemic. Absolutely agree. And this week, some things happening in our nation's capital. For one thing, Deb Haaland became the first Native American Secretary of the Interior when the Senate voted to confirm her.
And yes, the first sworn in traditional dress and moccasins, which was awesome.
Which is awesome. Yeah. And the first Native American to lead a cabinet agency, although not the first cabinet member. That would be Charles Curtis, Herbert Hoover's vice president back in the 1920s, about 100 years ago. So I guess you could say we've made some progress in a century, right? Deb Haaland is a member of the Laguna Pueblo Nation. She was confirmed on a mostly party line vote, 51-40, with only four Republicans voting for her. And those four Republicans are Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. She'll have a huge job ahead of her, not the least of which is to bring the Bureau of Land Management back to the center of power in Washington, D.C., after the Trump administration exiled the Bureau to Grand Junction, Colorado, which led to most of the professional staff resigning and leaving the department. And
that was the point.
Yeah, and that was the reason for the move, essentially. And that's pretty typical of the way that Trump has brutalized the federal government and many of the regulatory agencies in Washington, D.C. Deb Haaland is, I believe, the most progressive of Biden's candidates. She's opposed to oil and gas drilling on public lands, and she's against the construction of new oil and gas pipelines. She will oversee an expected ban on oil and gas drilling and an expansion of wind and solar power farms on public lands as part of the Biden climate agenda. She will also take control of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and is expected to make some major changes there as well. So congratulations.
Which are about a century overdue. Yeah.
Well, overdue. Yeah. So congratulations to her and some very good news this week.
Yeah.
Very good.
And then there was this shooting in Georgia, which was problematic on a number of fronts. We saw, it has emerged over the course of the week that the accused shooter was a member of a fundamentalist church and deeply, shall we say, conflicted over his sex drive, and decided to take it out on businesses, in this case, massage parlors that, he saw as temptations.
And of course, what struck me from the headlines was women dying. Again,
yeah,
because
yeah,
of a man.
I wanted to talk about that because
and his messed up sex drive.
Yeah, we had this messed up media response that was all about targeting Asians when it was really the shooting was really about targeting women, honestly, and it was also involved religion, obviously. But there's been no national conversation about either of those things, and that to me is kind of deeply disturbing because. While the hate crimes against Asian Americans is an important topic, six of the eight people who were killed were Asian women. And that seems to me to be the more germane category of why people were targeted.
And important to talk about the intersection of sexism with racism in this case and stereotypes about Asian women in particular.
Absolutely.
It's extremely important that we have that conversation, and I just haven't seen a lot of it.
And then again, we saw a lot of media coverage of the Cherokee County sheriff's spokesman basically excusing the shooting as the guy having a bad day, which, you know, a lot of us have bad days without engaging in mass murder. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there was also the law enforcement response. The one victim that was almost immediately identified was a white woman who, with her husband, was patronizing one of the establishments, a woman named Delaney Yon, who was also a person of color. But so was her husband. Her husband was Mexican-American, and he was arrested and detained for 4 hours by police on the scene without even being told if his wife had survived or not, let alone being allowed to see her. That is something that was reported in Spanish language media, but not in English language media that I can tell. And again, it, uh, it underscores that you know, the
problems with racism in the law enforcement agency on the scene.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. So there's a lot of dialogue that's been happening in mainstream media, but I think a lot of it has missed the point of lessons learned from that unfortunate incident on Tuesday.
Well, it also ties into the U.S. long history of its treatment and interactions with Asians, and U.S. imperialism is key in this whole discussion as well. You know, what is it that we send military forces to, you know, occupy these other countries, you know, basically bleed them dry of their resources, which people are one of the resources it uses. And then they're forced to eventually immigrate to the U.S. and then get treated like dirt.
Second-class citizens, yeah, expendables. Yeah.
And it further feeds this whole system.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen generations of immigration. I mean, going back to the, you know, the Boxer Rebellion and the Western occupation of Chinese ports. That's how we got a lot of Chinese laborers here in the 19th century. Spanish American War,
who essentially worked like slave labor on to build things like that, like the Transcontinental Railroad.
Exactly. You know, the Spanish American War fueled Filipino immigration here, and then our support of the Marcos regime in the you know 70s and 80s. And, you know, the Vietnam War, obviously. So there's been all of these different areas where the U.S. has intervened in foreign or Asian countries where the result is a diaspora and a lot of people emigrating here as a result and then being treated very badly here as a result. And, you know, we've, you know, going again to the shooting in Georgia, where a lot of the victims weren't identified for several days because the law enforcement didn't have people who could speak the languages of the different families. So the families couldn't be notified. And, you know, those resources in a city like Atlanta are certainly available, but law enforcement simply didn't avail themselves of them, or it took them a long time to locate those resources. Mm-hmm. Let alone having people within the agency who could speak the language.
Speaking of immigration, I want to very quickly talk a little bit about some things that happened this week.
We have a minute.
I can make it really fast. There is a surge in child immigrants at the southern border with the spring immigration season starting, and a lot of overcrowding in border control and ICE facilities near the border. The Biden administration is struggling to deal with over 1,000 changes that the Trump administration made in immigration programs, which has utterly broken our asylum system. Meanwhile, the House passed on Thursday a bill to create a path for 2.5 million immigrant dreamers to obtain citizenship on a nearly party-line vote, in spite of this being a widely popular notion among the U.S. population. And then they passed a second bill to give another 1.5 million farm workers a path to citizenship and update programs for agricultural workers, which 30 Republicans voted for. So this just shows you that the immigration system, which the Trump administration did their best to break, Congress, Democrats in Congress, and some Republicans are trying to fix, but the stumbling block is going to be the filibuster in the Senate, and we'll see if Democrats are able to overturn the filibuster and get some of their agenda passed through Congress this year.
And then finally, there is an event on Monday, the 22nd, be a memorial held in Seattle, put on by the Massage Parlor Outreach Project, that will be taking place from 9:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Hing He Park in the International District. So that's in response to Tuesdays.
Yeah, I believe that's at King and Maynard.
Okay. All right. Well, we will talk to you both the same time next week.
Okay.
I'll be here.